everybody. Welcome to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. We're here to call out stellar work by women in all parts of film and television and share some shows and films we're excited about.
We're a group of women writers, scholars, producers, and directors talking to you about women deserving heat in Tinseltown.
Ladies, heat it up!
A little bit about us.
Hi, I'm Jennifer. I'm a writer and painter, and my brand is Kick-Ass STEM Women.
Hi, I'm Heather, a writer from San Diego, and my brand is Sexy Monsters Killer Women.
Hey, I'm Safa. I'm an LA-based filmmaker and horror writer.
Hey, I'm Marie, the funny feminist screenwriter.
Kiki, a scholar and producer and advocate for the arts.
Hey, y'all. I'm Carrie. I'm a writer, director, and actress. I write stories about destiny changemakers.
We chose this episode's topic, actors and dramas, to highlight amazing actors making magic on the screen. And we're delighted to feature female-identified dramatic actors. The best actors are commonly thought to be those the audience can witness and believe, performers who move the watcher, making the watcher feel attached to the story or invested. For this episode, we highlight some of the incredibly talented women who make us turn on the waterworks in sad scenes, experience joy or delight in their successes, or believe who they are in their art in a way that allows us to view some aspect of life in a new way.
That was so liquid chocolate voice of you.
Oh, God.
Okay, so today's featured topic is serious acting, acting with chops. I'm totally excited about this episode. What did we all pick? Kiki, do you want to start us off?
Yes, I couldn't decide on one of the two sisters, so I picked Megan Good and Journey Smollett for their roles in Eve's Bayou. The roles that they played as two sisters reminded me a lot of my two younger sisters, and being older than them, I was just able to glean a lot about generational trauma and magic and things that occur in African-American families that don't really get discussed outside of film.
So what did you think brought out the really amazing performances in the actresses?
I feel like the parents and the environment that they grew up in, and in the bayou in New Orleans where all the magic resides. I visited New Orleans once and I could feel the spirit in the street. It's such a magical place, and I feel like that definitely contributed to what they were able to bring to the roles, the environment, the scene, or that the film was filmed in.
Tell me about the interaction between Megan Good and Journey Smollett in the story that brought out the drama that really connected with you emotionally.
It was kind of like an older sister versus a younger sister. You know, I'm the oldest. I have two younger sisters. So it was really being able to see played out on screen the sibling rivalry. It's how girls fight with one another, the little backbiting things that they do. What was your sister's nickname, Sasha?
Brat.
See? You know? Okay? She gets it. And that's the interactions between these two actresses. It's that. And I love this film so much. And just to see that these two women went from being child stars to being the superstars that they are today, it really reinforces for me that dreams are real and they don't die off of the screen.
And it must be cool if their performances were so good together that you really saw them as sisters as you were watching. I love it when I see that kind of enactment that makes me forget who the person is and really live in the film.
That's
how you were feeling when you were watching this movie too?
Yeah, I was definitely transported.
Yeah.
For sure.
Is one of them named Eve? Eve's Bayou? Who's Eve?
Journey Smollett's character's name is Eve, and Megan Good's character's name is Cecily, and their last name is Batiste. And it's really interesting in the character dynamics. Eve, who's the younger sister played by Journey, she has a psychic gift. So whenever her sister lies to her, really interesting things happen.
So is it scary? Is it like a
ghost? It's a little bit of a ghost story, family mystery, healing of generational trauma.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's voodoo, hoodoo, American folk magic, all of that in there.
I actually can't believe I haven't seen this. I'm extremely excited to watch this. I love when things sort of bend genre, and this is fantastic.
Yeah. Awesome. So Jennifer, why don't you tell us what you're featuring today?
So I'm doing Aubrey Plaza in the film Emily the Criminal. Aubrey has incredible range. Seeing her in The White Lotus, where her hair's all coiffed, wearing beautiful outfits with this Barbara Stanwyck sharp wit, is a world away from her character in Emily the Criminal. Emily's not confident in the way her character Harper is in The White Lotus. She wears the same pants she works in at food service. Her hair looks unwashed and messy. She's $70,000 in student debt, but with no degree. She's got an assault charged by an ex-boyfriend, which makes getting a job awkward and humiliating. She went to art school, but doesn't have the money to paint. Her character is the perfect example of someone getting sucked into the system and spat out. So the film jumps in with a job interview, and right away, she's nervous and desperate. And when the guy asks if she has a record, saying they don't check for that, she gives a story that's not true, and then he calls her on it, wanting to know all the details of the assault. But Emily is having none of it. Her face goes from eager congeniality to furious. When she tells him off, I cheer. But then it's back to her menial food service job with no regular schedule and little pay. So when a coworker asks if she'd like to make $200 in 1 hour, of course she's way into it. After finding out it's a dummy shopper using stolen credit cards, she almost leaves. Once she does the job, you can see how she takes to it with an intensity she's never known before. She's good at being a criminal. The stakes quickly go high, and with every job, the ante goes up, and so do the odds that she will get hurt. So even though there's no gun violence, and that's a choice that Aubrey said was intentional, there's danger in every scene. So Emily defends herself with pepper spray and a taser, but she's dealing with men and she does not go unscathed. The believability of Emily's journey comes from John Pattenford's script. His examination of the life of legal enslavement to student debt leads us to want her to achieve a legal freedom. As a first-time director, he was so lucky to have Aubrey as his tour de force lead. Emily the Criminal is a fast-paced, tightly plotted thriller, and at the heart is Aubrey Plaza's intense, subtle performance. There's no doubt that she can lead any dramatic role. She's magnetic in every scene, vulnerable yet assertive. She's just captivating. I would watch her in anything she's in. And I heard about it because it came out in 2022, and Barack Obama listed it as one of his favorite films. And I was like, oh, look at that. I didn't even know she's in a film. And so thanks, Obama.
Hey. She's doing people's work still.
Yeah, I mean, she's
a pretty young actress too, right? So we have a long timeline ahead where we can watch her performing in a lot of films.
Okay.
Well, I'm excited to watch this Emily the Criminal. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. It just sounds like what a great age and a great life place. And like for starting for $200, right? It says so much about where she starts as a character. I remember seeing the climax of it for writing. Oh. And it really was so powerful. And it has this modern edge. And I do love just her as an actress, that it's got this deadpan with this like piece of like authenticity in it. Yeah. She's just great.
The scenes where they swipe the credit card and then you wait. So, oh my God, please go through.
I love that you picked this movie because it has an art school element to it too.
Yeah.
And I love that it has this topical thing of student loan debt. I think there's a big audience for that, right?
Right. And just like, what if I could just go and move out of the country and not have any debt at all?
And become a criminal. No.
Well, I mean, but if you can make it work and you don't die, I don't know.
I hear you. Well, I mean, like, break the law without breaking the law.
Okay.
This whole group has another career of like a high school routine. We got to break into the basement.
Thelma and Louise. There you go. Louise. Thelma and Louise 5. No.
Right?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, Sasha, I bring it to you for some lightness and levity. Just kidding. What have you got for us today?
Lightness and levity with face hugging aliens. That's how I roll with my lightness.
Oh, I'm
and
ready.
Levity. No, honestly, when it came to the subject, like the first person that came to mind was Sigourney Weaver in the Alien franchise, specifically Alien and Aliens. I saw the movie when I was way too young by sneak watching it while my dad thought I was asleep. You know what? Let me have my childhood trauma. But no, I mean, Sigourney Weaver in that movie, in the first two specifically that I saw when I was a kid, that was the first time I got to see the badass woman in a film because, you know, it was the 90s and all of the action movies and badass characters were your Sylvester Stallone, your Arnold Schwarzenegger's, that sort of thing. And this was like the first time I got to see an absolute woman on screen. And then, of course, I got my Sarah Connors and stuff like that afterwards. And it actually was the thing that sparked my absolute love for horror and sci-fi and fantasy. And I mean, her performance was obviously brilliant. Sigourney Weaver was nominated for an Oscar for Aliens. People don't remember that because it's not the kind of movie that normally gets that kind of awards attention, but she was strong, but still, you know, definitely going through, especially in Aliens, like the PTSD of her experience. She was maternal, but she was a badass. The moment, if you've seen the film, where she comes down the elevator to the Queen's lair, King Fernute, where she has that moment and then it's like something comes down over her face where she's focused, is one of the most brilliant moments of acting that I've still ever seen. Just, I think, be the rose-tinted childhood goggles, but she's just so fucking brilliant in the film. She has all of the emotions and is still such a badass.
Yeah, she's iconic in that. I mean, I feel like even saying her name and then the film, I just immediately am picturing so many scenes from the film.
I don't think I've ever seen a performance as strong as hers in Alien. It was outstanding.
It really was. She was a female embodiment of strength and love. She was tender and strong at the same time, fiercely strong, and then tender, saving Newt. It was incredible. I agree, Sasha. It was my first introduction to a female lead as well.
And the best thing is that, and a lot of people don't know this, is that the first Alien movie, the character of Ripley was written to be a man.
Oh.
So the original script, the character was a man. It's kind of like the movie, oh God, what was it? Salt, with Angelina Jolie, where she's also an absolute badass. That was originally written to be a man. So it's always fun for me personally when I see these badass women roles where they originally were like, oh, this is totally a man. And then somebody comes in along the way and they're like, oh, but we want this person, or what if we do this instead? And it's just something really cool to me about that particular aspect.
Definitely.
I was going to say, then it just became like, this is one of those movies that changes everything. Like whenever you do reading about strong female characters, Ripley will always show up as an example. Yes. And so it's like Sigourney made a big change.
And so, Sasha, how did Sigourney Weaver get the role if it was written for a man? Who made that decision?
I actually don't know. I've actually researched the movie before in a class that I was doing on screenwriting. And I mean, the information might be out there and I just didn't have the Google prowess to find it. But Ridley Scott did the first Alien movie, and obviously James Cameron the second one. The first one is more of a horror film. I would actually think the second one's more like an action sci-fi film, but kind of like pick your poison on which one you like more. So I don't know.
Alien was released in 1979 and directed by Ridley Scott, and I think it was a movie ahead of its time with a female lead. And in Aliens in 1986, then directed by James Cameron, I believe followed by Alien 3 in 1992. And I think there was one more, right, Sasha?
Alien Resurrection. I think that came out in like 98 or something like that. This is me actually guessing, so if I'm wrong, don't shoot me.
She plays so intelligent. You can see just the intelligence. It's almost like in her eyes or something, in her delivery. She just brings the strength and intelligence to all of her characters, which I really love.
She's absolutely brilliant in everything. Honestly, obviously, around that same time period, like in the 80s, she also did Ghostbusters movies, which were brilliant, and she was hilarious and funny in those as well. So honestly, every time I'm watching something and Sigourney Weaver pops up, I'm just like, well, this is a great surprise. This just made whatever I thought before 10 times better. The giddiness I felt when I saw the Ghostbusters reboot with that was Kristen Wiig and them, when she popped up, I was just like, I literally sat up in the movie theater. I was like, oh, is that Sigourney? I knew there would be cameos, but I was so happy to see her.
What I think is really cool about Aliens and Sigourney Weaver in particular, going back to that idea of women and power, is that it seems to me like the role that she has in this, and being as personally powerful with as much personal agency as she has without being a villain, is what made that stick out to me as just a really phenomenal kind of paradigm shift in the way that you could see roles for women changing. So I'm just going to echo that being awesome, because that's what I thought also when I saw that movie. I thought, why aren't there more powerful powerful women who aren't depicted as the enemy or a villain.
Or that no one saved her.
That's the joy you find in horror and could find even before this. I just feel like because she was nominated for an award and because it was this and that, it brought more to it. But the final girl, the quote unquote final girl in horror and things like that has existed a long time. And that is the badass character. That's how the final girl archetype came to be, is that it was that final girl who stopped the bad guy, who killed the killer, who solved the problem. And that's the beauty of horror that I first found with the Alien franchise.
Yeah, I definitely can wholeheartedly stand behind that sentiment because of that archetype of character.
Oh yeah. It's rare that you find a final boy. I mean, enough that there's actually a documentary about what they consider to be the first final boy.
Oh, really?
Well, I also love that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm remembering about Aliens is that the whole movie, she knows what to do, right? It's always her telling them and not being listened, and then we got to do it her way anyway. She's got to come in and fix this problem.
I mean, the whole movie was supposed to be like an allegory for the Vietnam War, which is a bunch of a superior fighting force in the Marines that go with her to the planet, thinking that they're the badasses that are going to be there. Because primitive aliens or whatever. And she warns them and she's like, look, I need you guys to all have your shit together and understand how dangerous this is, because one of those aliens killed my entire crew in the first movie and there might be more of them. And then of course, when all hell breaks loose, she takes control because she's just like, I cannot deal with you people. This is what needs to happen. And
just you describing it, I want to jump out of my seat and cheer. It's so powerful.
I mean, honestly, yeah. Aliens is that movie that I watch when I am sad. Aliens is the movie that I watch when I want to celebrate. Aww. Aliens is probably the movie that started my love of movies.
Well, I mean, like, coming after Sigourney Weaver would be pretty hard if I didn't have an awesome actress I myself will feature today.
Okay,
so my choice is not fighting aliens per se, although I do think that both Sigourney Weaver and the actress I chose have extreme amounts of strength and influence in what they've done and the roles that they've picked. But I have selected an actress who's been in so many roles, and she just blows my mind for how each time I see her, she's something else. So she's a recipient of the EGOT. Is that what they say? All of the main awards? And of course, I'm talking about the divine Meryl Streep. So I picked Sophie's Choice today, which is an older film that came out in 1984. And it is one of her earlier films, though she was already professionally acting to acclaim in the 70s. So keep in mind, this is more than a decade into her acting career. It came out and is about Sophie, a Polish immigrant to America with a dark past, who shares a boarding house in Brooklyn with her mentally ill lover, Nathan, and a writer character named Stingo. So this is one of those other films that I really like because it is one of those films that could be classified in a lot of different ways. Yes, it's a drama. It's about a tortured past, living with a tortured past. It's about having a relationship with someone mentally ill. It's about all of the things that Southern Gothic novelists bring to a narrative. It's about being in a confined space boarding house. And one thing I really like about this movie and her performance in particular is that it evokes the stage and the novelesque. And so her portrayal is seeped with the complexity of the character's past and the difficulty of the character's present. And I just thought, nailed it. She did it. As a woman in love with a paranoid schizophrenic who is in turns extremely extravagant and fabulous and exuberant and terrifying. Just when you're watching her scenes with Kevin Kline, this was his first feature big film, and you're watching her scenes with him and you don't know whether to be afraid for her or happy for her. You don't know whether to feel that she should run from him or whether she even can, because her love dynamic with him is presented so clearly and with so much cognitive dissonance as someone in that situation would actually feel. So, I mean, oh my God, I could just watch that movie and several different shots from it and feel very enmeshed in what she's doing.
She's incredible. incredible. She draws you in. She does that thing with her eyes where she's almost crying.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's mesmerizing because you feel all these emotions. That's a brutal film that you chose.
It's brutal. It's brutal. Yeah.
I'd like to say that I watch Devil Wears Prada when I'm happy or when I'm sad. Okay. She's so phenomenal. And absolutely, to me, Meryl Streep is one of the greatest of all time.
That, like, when I think of an iconic female actor, I think of all of the excellent, the amazing facets of acting that people can nail or they can fail at. I love the way that she has the movement of her characters be so natural and so authentic to each role. And I love also about her that she just has this warm and beloved space in the minds and hearts of people in the industry and in the audience. And I think that was definitely something that drove me to picking her too.
Holly, it might just be a Hollywood urban legend, but my understanding is that for Sophie's Choice, because she's such a dedicated actress, she learned so that she could speak German in a Polish accent.
Wow.
That, I mean, again, it might just be a Hollywood urban legend, but I've heard it more than once, and I want to believe it's true, even if it's not, just because of just how brilliant she was. Part of my brain's just like, she did not just speak German. I mean, I lived in Germany as a kid, and and I remember seeing it and being like, that is a Polish accent speaking German. Okay, cool.
Wow.
It's so funny because I totally wanted to talk about her accents. Can we talk about her accents and how many films and accents that she's done? Danish, out of Africa. British, The French Lieutenant's Woman, Plenty, The Iron Lady. Italian, Bridges of Madison County. Southern American, The Seduction of Joe Tynan. Minnesotan, Upstate New York, Bronx. Through all of these different films, she does so many accents. And she even had one where she was playing a New Zealand transplant to Australia with that accent in that film, Evil Angels. But so Sophie's Choice was almost top on my list because of that too. Actually, the Wikipedia says that she spoke English and German with a Polish accent, as well as Polish itself in Sophie's Choice. That's pretty so
not
amazing.
An urban legend. Yes, I love it.
That's amazing. Yeah,
it's amazing. And then somebody asked her when she was in Belfast, how she reproduces different accents. And she replied, in, I guess, a perfect accent for that area. I listen. Yeah. Right? So she's just amazing in so many ways. And she brings in all of the things that you want to see and all of the talents that you want to see. And I just want to call out one quick thing that Mike Nichols said about her. And he directed Streep in Silkwood, Heartburn, Postcards from the Edge, and Angels in America. He praised her ability to transform herself, which is something that as an audience member totally strikes me in the heart because that's what I think is true too. And he said, in every role, she becomes a totally new human being. As she becomes the person she is portraying, the other performers begin to react to her as if she were that person.
It's true. She really ups every scene. Even when she was doing Only Murders in the Building, she was incredible in that. And it really leveled up everyone.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
If I'm not mistaken, she won her second Oscar for Sophie's Choice after Kramer versus Kramer as well.
Yes. That was her breakout film, Kramer versus Kramer. And that was an incredible performance in the late 70s, I believe. One of the first really adult films I saw as a kid. And I remember seeing that and thinking, wow, Meryl Streep. And I was so young. And then to see her whole career arc as it has, she played Margaret Thatcher in Iron Lady all the way to the role in Mamma Mia. What an incredible vast she possesses.
And one of my favorite Meryl Streep moments was, she was the narrator. What do you call it when you read an audiobook? She was the reader of an audiobook, a novel written by Nora Ephron. Ooh. And I'm a big audiobook consumer, and
Meryl
took it to a different planet. It was just like, this is the power of acting, that with her voice, this just transformed into something miraculous. I mean, and starting from something that was Nora Ephron, which already is amazing. I feel like that's my audiobook high that I'm always chasing. Like, can I get another hit of Meryl Streep and Nora Ephron?
Oh, amazing. Yeah, for sure. And again, one more little note from the Mike Nichols page. He said that directing her is, and this is a quote, so much like falling in love that it has the characteristics of a time which you remember as magical, but which is shrouded in mystery.
That's beautiful.
I know. And I fall in love with her again and again and again and again. I really today actually wanted to feature her film Silkwood because that film was so eye-opening and she stays in my memory very strongly for that, as well as more recent work. But I picked Sophie's Choice just because I thought her characterization of a woman in love having that kind of past was just so tragic and so timeless. But I just feel like I watched her transform so many times. So I picked Sophie's Choice, but I could equally have picked any number of her other films. So yay, kudos to Meryl. She's awesome.
I have a question for you, Heather. I feel like I saw an episode of something where they had somebody had a party that was a dress as your favorite Meryl Streep character. Who would you most enjoy dressing as? Which of her characters would you just love to strut around as?
Okay, well, I think I would want to dress like Margaret Thatcher just for fun.
Yes.
And then I would sing Sinead O'Connor while I was dressed as Margaret Thatcher to enhance the irony of the choice. Yeah.
I love it.
Well, Carrie, what do you got for us? Tell us what you picked for today's episode.
Oh, well, thank you. I am presenting Helen McCrory for her role as Polly Gray, affectionately known as Aunt Polly, from the Netflix series Peaky Blinders. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Peaky Blinders, it was a 6-season Netflix series in Ireland. Lead character is Shelby, and he is played by Cillian Murphy. He has a gang named the Peaky Blinders that control the city of Birmingham. And Shelby's ambitions extend beyond Birmingham as he plans to build on the business empire he's created and dispatch anyone that gets in his way. Helen McCrory plays the role of Aunt Polly, which is an incredible role. She really is the second star, if you will, of the series. An incredible example of an enduring talent as she plays this role through several years as the series is being filmed up into the 5th season. And I picked her for several reasons, but mainly because she could consistently portray her character with the same level of consistent intensity and through all of these incredible seasons. It really struck me because it was all so consistent. And then when I learned that she was battling breast cancer through the last season or two, and that she ultimately succumbed to breast cancer and was no longer able to film season 6. She had passed right before they were about to resume filming season 6. It moved me in an incredible way because if you read her story, she never really told many people about her breast cancer illness. She was very private about it. She basically hid it from the majority of the cast and crew because she was such a professional. She didn't want any sympathy or any attention drawn to her. She only wanted to continue acting. She's also well known for many other, in particular, Narcissa Malfoy in the Harry Potter films. She's a British actor. She acted up until just about the start of the 6th season for Peaky Blinders. However, COVID took place, so production came to a halt 5 days before they were about to resume filming. And in that time frame between when they picked back up to film again, unfortunately, she passed away. However, she's known for her incredible philanthropy. And COVID, she organized and created a charity that orchestrated high-end restaurants to deliver food to service industry workers and keep everybody fed. She was adored even more than she was in person for all of her work and philanthropy. And she was only 52 when she passed away.
Wow.
And breast cancer is a very female-centric illness. And I just really wanted to touch on an actress that even though she's no longer with us, she too could have arced in her career like a Meryl Streep or another great actress, but her life was cut short. And in her role, they love and they hate Aunt Polly. And as an actress, to be able to portray loved and then hated at the same time, she was so fiercely dedicated to her family. She would kill people for her family. She would make sure that her family was safe, despite how despicable they were and that they were a gang of essentially killers. And everybody should have an Aunt Polly.
Her favorite character.
Yeah.
Yes.
She was so independent. This one scene where once they started getting money, when they got fancier, yes, and then they sort of broke apart and everybody was sort of living separately. And she had this corset thing on and going through these pleasure ecstasies, and you realize this dude is going down on her and she's standing.
Yes, I love that.
It's oh my God, she's amazing.
She's a power move.
Yes. That was an incredible incredible scene. You got to really see from the very beginning of that series when they were dirt poor, living in this tiny house. And then when they get rich, and you're right, her wardrobe changes, but really the person of who she was, her strength and commitment and loyalty to family was ever present and unchanging and powerful. And as an actress, how she was able to continue that thread from the beginning of the series to the end of the series, that same consistent thread as an actress, incredible. And all of the changes, it's wonderful to see actresses and actors in films where they portray different characters in different films, but to see an actress arc change over years playing the same character, and then as that character within the series changes, but yet is able to keep that baseline, that foundation of her character that she continued to consistently portray, I found awe-inspiring. And then once to learn she did it all while battling breast cancer.
Right.
It moved me greatly. And I'm delighted to present her to our audiences and to all of you, and encourage you to go back and take some sneak peeks of her in Peaky Blinders and in other incredible films. She was really a revered British actress, and she played in British films such as The Queen, The Special Relationship. She played the wife to Tony Blair in several films. Like I mentioned, three of the Harry Potter films. She also played Mama Jean in Martin Scorsese's family film Hugo. She was in a James Bond film, Skyfall, in 2012, where she played the character of Claire Dower. So she had quite a career. I do believe it was cut quite short. And I'm just excited to be able to share her and her legacy with our audiences.
I think that one of the things I really loved is when they got rich and she would wear these amazing, amazing outfits. And the way that she would just walk around, she was really the heart of the show.
She really was. And she had that walk before they became rich, really.
Oh, I know, right?
But what I found, and I love you bring this point up, what I found striking about that is she was just as regal earlier than when she was when they became rich and wore these clothes. Like the regalness was always there. It was always there. I don't know. I found that also quite striking about how she could play the character.
Right. She wore the clothes. The clothes did not wear her.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
And you know what I think is actually fascinating, because a lot of us here write TV shows or movies and things like that, and we're working on that. And whenever there's a character who is just continuously fascinating across a number of seasons, is it just me that I always think that writer must have been partially in love with that character? That actress inspired the writer in this kind of like circling love affair of love of the performance and then creation of character. And so I always get excited about that dynamic as well when I see someone really excellent who season after season continues to have interesting things to do.
You know, I agree. Totally. I feel, I know the creator, Peaky Blinders, Stephen Knight, must have had an incredible aunt in his life, or always wanted to have an aunt, or knew of an aunt. It was really inspiring him to write this character with such explicit detail and fullness. It had to be, because you loved her and you hated her at the same time, because she was incredibly vicious. She would just plow down people that got in her way to protect her family. But it was an incredible performance to see her carry this character all the way through five seasons.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Can I just add this one thought to it too, is that when you know that an actress is amazing and you know you're writing toward them, I feel almost like that gives the writer this extra license to use all known skills. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
Well, oh my gosh, wonderful. So Marie, we haven't heard from you yet though. Can you tell us what you picked for this episode?
I am so excited to tell you about this. Even at the moment we started talking about conceiving this podcast, like we're going to talk about women in Hollywood, and in my head it just was running like, Gina Davis, got to talk about Gina. So this is like a moment for me, guys. I want to thank you for this. So I want to talk about Gina Davis, and there are so many movies to pick from her, but it will be Thelma and Louise. I feel like that's just such an iconic role for her. But I feel like it's so important to note that she is so much more than an actor. She has changed Hollywood. So she's had this amazing career playing strong women, playing interesting women, but she also founded the Gina Davis Institute on Gender and Media. And I just want to shout that out and just mention that. And she's really worked hard with that. Yeah. With that institute to really work in substantive and very real ways, like practical ways to get more representation of diversity on screens. And one of the things that I've heard her say is that if she can see it, she can be it. Like, as modeling for girls and women, that as soon as you put women in roles showing that they can do things, that all of a sudden in real life, women start doing it. It's called the CSI effect. So when, and CSI, they started having so many women doing the forensics jobs, all of a sudden there's this huge uptick in women studying forensics and getting involved. So same thing happened with Hunger Games, with archery. All of a sudden it ballooned the number of girls that were doing archery. So she's just done so much. And I love that what she's done is so fact-based. She does research. She does these studies to give us numbers.
Didn't she try out for the Olympics as an archer?
She did, and I don't know the full story of it, but she did. She didn't quite make it, but she almost made it.
It's like a really good archer. Before Hunger Games, there was Gina Davis.
Hey, shout out that too. Gina Davis.
Like, I didn't even know that. That's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah, and she's so humble. I really dug deep on this just because I loved learning about her and just that she's so smart, so humble, and she lives in this reality. You know, like she talks about the reality of Hollywood, the reality of her experience, and yet she's so calm about it, but she's really addressing some pretty major issues that have been raised around the treatment of women in the industry. So she's just really amazing. And I would also shout out a documentary, This Changes Everything, that she produced. And that was, it's again all about women in Hollywood. She's also a great actress, right? She did Tootsie, she was in The Fly, Beetlejuice, Accidental Tourist, League of Their Own, so many ones. And of course, I really want to talk about Thelma and Louise. I do want to say I put out a little trigger warning here. Thelma and Louise, in this discussion, it does have some sensitive topics. So if you are potentially sensitive about them, this might be hit the pause button or earmuffs. Okay, what I love about Thelma and Louise, the basic storyline is that it's a housewife and a waitress. They're starting out going on a vacation, and it ends up being that Thelma, who is played by Gina Davis, she's a very skittish person. She's innocent, and that's this beautiful thing that Gina Davis can play, is sort of innocence that grows into strength. So she has
badassery.
Yes.
Yeah. She has an innocence that grows into badassery as well.
Badassery.
I love it. Badassery.
Yeah, we trigger warning, so we can say whatever we want right now. And she starts out with this skittishness. She's always worried, are people mad at me? She's sort of afraid of her husband that's really overpowering. When they go on this trip, they stop and they go to a bar. She has a bunch of drinks, and this is the beginning of her a bit coming out of her shell. But she dances with a man that ends up attempting to rape her and gets very close to doing it. But Louise comes in and holds him up by gunpoint and interrupts it. So she's saved from that moment. But when the rapist does stop and he starts taunting them and saying, I should have completed it, Louise shoots him. And so from there, they're on the run from the law. And it's so powerful seeing how Gina Davis plays this woman through such a range. So she's in shock after this rape, but she's confused. But a big part of their journey forward is she ends up having a brief affair with a hitchhiker they caught up, who, by the way, was Brad Pitt's big breakout role. So it's her mistake because she's naive. So she hasn't really questioned who this person is. He's a hitchhiker, right? And he ends up stealing all their money. And from there, things escalate. But she also, that's her moment of taking responsibility. She robs a store. And I don't want to give away too much, but it's this journey of her growing and becoming strong and being badass. But the film itself also, in some ways, is sort of like a metaphor for the female experience, right? So yes, they are on a criminal journey, so to speak, but at each point, it's prompted by men putting them in that position. And there are things that I see are like, okay, we can all relate to that feeling of things happen to me and I can't do anything about it, right? And not that I would advocate literally doing, but as this metaphor, they just fight back and they hold their own, and they are the literally driving the car of their life in this. And then there's the famous last scene where they go off the cliff together rather than be arrested. It's so powerful what they did. I feel like it's hard to not also talk about how amazing Susan Sarandon is in this, because she also is just an actress that plays so subtly. At the beginning of this movie, Gina Davis' innocence, it's so amazing the way she plays it, because in a little bit of a way, she's so innocent and sweet, but it's almost a little annoying, right? She's so almost naive that you can see Louise just being like tolerating this, like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. It's a really subtle choice to make, and I think I feel a lot of it is like in the delivery. I'm just so excited about this movie and what it did and how it handled so many things. I mean, honestly, I want to do like every episode. I'm like, there's got to be some Thelma and Louise tie-in.
It was a powerful film because no other, it's a buddy film. It's a buddy crime and film. And I think it was the first women-centric buddy crime film. It really made a big impact.
I think that there's so little, I mean, in the real world that rape victims can do. Mm-hmm. To have agency. And there's so many women who've been sexually assaulted at some point in their life that this movie hit a huge chord for a huge audience, just because it is nice to see women have some sort of standing up and having some agency and having some reaction that isn't just to accept the trauma, if that makes
sense. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I feel like that was one of the most powerful things about the film overall, was that it was like taking a stand on the bigger system, right? And they talk about it, like, should we turn ourselves in? No, they'll never believe us. They'll never take our side. Like, yeah. We don't have physical evidence. And those are all the things that are very, very real.
I also like how they became epic in this film. I mean, for sure. What the decisions that were made were for how they chose to end the film.
I know.
Shock and awe.
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
Bring it back to the sisterhood of that moment that you just mentioned, Heather. Apparently, originally at the end of the script, before they go, spoiler alert, go over the cliff, was supposed to be this big dialogue between the two characters. And Susan, on the day, I guess, or at some point, I believe it was Susan Sarandon, was like, we know each other. They don't need all of this. I'm just going to kiss her. And that's how that came about. Apparently, there was like a speech and dialogue in that point where they were almost discussing it and how much they meant to each other. And she was just like, we don't need that. I'm just going to kiss her. We're going to say we love each other. And then we're going to go.
Wow.
And I think that's one of the things that makes it so beautiful, is because you didn't need that conversation, because both actresses were so good in their parts, and the connection that they had as characters and the chemistry, that you knew that they loved each other, you knew that they would die for each other, that they knew this was the end of their journey, and there was no discussion that had to be had, just, I love you too, and go.
Another thing it takes on is the smaller things that women tolerate. There's a truck driver that they keep running into because it's on the same road that they're on, and he keeps basically sexually harassing them with lewd gestures, lewd comments, and they finally pull him over, him thinking that he's going to finally get a taste of the goods. And what they do is, like, at gunpoint, they're just trying to make him apologize. And he will not apologize. And so they blow up the, like, gas tanker he's taking. And it's just one of these moments where you're like, there are so many little moments where we've been something a little lewd, something a little comfortable. And, like, you're just like, yeah, kind of, they blew it up, you know? I can't do it in real life, but such a moment.
Yeah, kind of like wish fulfillment of what you'd like to react with microaggressions as a woman in the world.
Yes.
That's true. That's it right there, right?
Like, yeah. How I'd like to respond versus how I can appropriately respond.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I can safely respond also sometimes.
You know, safely.
Safe. Some other things just about the film that I loved was, oh, this is the technical term that maybe the audience will like to learn. It's mise en scène. Yeah, right. That's all the set dressing and the props that add to the story, add to how you understand the characters to be. And there's just so much beautiful comparison of back at home with the husband and the cops. It's like rainy and wet and in a way lush, but meanwhile these women are driving across desert, and just like the props and that beautiful green car. And then moving into like costuming, you see them change from like Thelma's sort of princess-like almost. She's wearing this white flowy dress, and by then she's got a trucker's cap on, she's got a denim shirt with the sleeves ripped off. It's just, the visuals are amazing.
Well, I just want to say, Marie, talking about their costuming, they get more comfortable in themselves. Like before, she's wearing a dress and order to please men and to look pleasing, and she's wearing a lot of makeup and blue eyeshadow, and then they get this authentic self look with their bandana and, like you said, the truck hat. You really feel like that's their authentic selves.
Yeah. Yes, that's a great point.
Yeah, she has this moment, she has this scene where they're driving, things have gotten really bad, and it's the middle of the night, and Thelma says, do you feel awake? I've never felt this awake in my life. And it's just like such a beautiful line for like a woman awakening into her next self, you know?
I just want to point out here something that I think is really interesting about a couple of the women that we chose today. So Gina Davis always reminds me of a Steel Magnolia in that she always seems like a pretty little flower at the beginning of the movie because she has this kind of persuader personality type that comes through a lot of her characters. Like in Beetlejuice, definitely like in Thelma and Louise, like in A League of Their Own at the beginning, she seems to be a character that you might have some fear would be more fragile, but her core is steel. So I think what's cool is you can see kind of the developing of a quiet strength through a lot of her characters, which is beautiful. Whereas Sigourney, I feel like she shows up strong and she's just strong, you know, and you can see that kind of power emanating from her. I think Gina Davis is like the stealth power. And then Sigourney is like the, I'm here, it's present. And then Meryl Streep is like, my power is mystery. Well, I think we have an amazing list. Okay, so we'll post this list on the launch day of this episode at the Hot Redhead Media blog. So you can go check out all these awesome films and TV shows and clap back if you have more to say. But it's snack time. What snacks do we need for this extravaganza? Whose snack pick is it today?
It's me. I've got the snack for you. Know that the title alone of my snack might ward you off, but I'm telling you, it's delicious. Yes, there's a trigger warning here too under our snack. It's called Bar Snack Brussels Sprouts Steeped in Olive Oil and Fish Sauce. Okay. Ooh. I know. Fish sauce. I had to make a batch because I didn't believe it'd be so good. I read about this
recipe. I love how she acts like fish sauce is what the deterrent is. I think Brussels sprouts would be the first
one. All right. So it's from a chef, Gabrielle Hamilton at Prune in New York City. And she said they'd make a pound and then everyone would eat them before they even ate dinner. Then they made 2 pounds and they ate it all again. They serve it like a bar snack and it goes faster than olives. Now that I've tried them, I'm telling you, these are really, really good. And these will be on our blog too. But right now I'll just tell you how to make it because it's super easy. It only takes 15 minutes, but then you have to let it rest for an hour to steep in those flavors. And there's only 4 ingredients. Kosher salt, Brussels sprouts, olive oil, and Vietnamese fish sauce, which you can get really anywhere. So this is what you do. You bring a large pot of water to boil and you season with kosher salt until it's salty as the sea. And you should actually get a spoon and taste the hot water for salinity because it's the only way to know what you've got in the pot. Then you add the Brussels sprouts and you cook for 10 minutes until they're just cooked through, still firm, but not al dente. Then you drain them and you put them in a heat-proof shallow bowl. And while it's still hot, you douse them with good quality olive oil, about 2 tablespoons. And then you sprinkle fish sauce over them, like 1.5 tablespoons. And you stir and taste one. And then if it needs more fish sauce, you can add it. Then you let the sprouts cool completely, resting and steeping for an hour or so. And then you serve them at room temperature. And they are grub. And this isn't just any bar food. Brussels sprouts have a ton of vitamin C. Like 1 cup gives you 124% of your daily allowance. And there's 2 cups in this recipe. There's also iron, vitamin B6, magnesium. I mean, I don't work for the Brussels sprouts lobby, but yeah, I'm pro Brussels sprout. And Carrie, you're a nurse, so you know nursey things about health.
Nurse practitioner, in fact. Brussels sprouts are also known for their high folate content, which is an essential B vitamin that helps maintain proper cell health. These little sprouts contain tons of fiber, which aids in digestion and promoting healthy gut. Also, the antioxidants in Brussels sprouts contribute to overall well-being, potentially reducing inflammation and supporting heart health. Including these cruciferous vegetables in your diet can be a delicious way to enhance your nutritional intake. Other cruciferous vegetables, in case you're curious, are broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage. Brussels sprouts are part of the cabbage and cruciferous vegetable family.
Yeah. And the other thing is you're going to eat them with alcohol. And so, you know, you're just like, hey, I'm getting all my vitamin C. I'm not going to get scurvy.
Have it with a glass of red wine, then you get some more antioxidants.
Right. So. And also cows love Brussels sprouts and they're really good for them. And that's for our listeners of the first episode.
Back to our first episode, Jennifer, with that beautiful film, First Cow.
Yes, full circle moment.
Yeah.
And also, Kiki, your film, Eve's Bayou, because wasn't the cow's name Eve in First Cow?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, look at that coincidence. Look at that.
Oh, man. We're
I just have one thing to say after this delicious Brussels sprout and cruciferous discussion, which is that I think my new self-description is going to be I'm cruciferous and salty as the sea.
Oh, my God.
Cruciferous. What, cruciferous and salty as the sea?
And salty.
Yeah. I'm cruciferous and salty as the sea. I'm ready for that.
That's good. If you say it with as a pirate, I.
Yeah.
Because they were really at risk for scurvy. Yeah.
It's I know. Perfect. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's really good for pirates.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Oh, I think it might be Femblast trivia time. Go for it, Kate. Can you tell us?
Trivia time. It's trivia time. In the first episode, we gave the trivia question. What Oscar-winning actress at 41 was warned as a child that her career would fall off a cliff at the age of 35, which is something she said she knew a lot of women face, but then said the thing that has evolved during that time is that more women are having careers deeper into their lives, which I think is fantastic. The answer is Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway gave us a wonderful quote. Also starred in one of my favorite films with Meryl Streep, The Devil Wears Prada, which I mentioned earlier. So yeah, another full circle moment.
Yes.
Next episode, we will be highlighting costume designers. The first woman to direct a film also wrote, produced, and created costume designs for her work. Who was she? And I'll give you a hint. The film was narrative fiction called The Cabbage Fairy.
This is great because this is cruciferous.
It's so-
yeah. I don't know. Is that really?
Oh my God. Were you not listening to Carrie?
Oh, I'm sorry. Carrie say broccoli. Okay.
Named cabbage. She named cauliflower. I was listening. You can't use the word cruciferous.
I think I've seen this short film. Yeah.
Cabbage. Those,
just for clarity, cruciferous vegetables include broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kale, bok choy, arugula, Brussels sprouts, collards, watercress, and radishes. So thank you, Kiki, for bringing us all back to the cruciferous.
Because we're cruciferous. Okay, we're cruciferous.
Can be the name of our heist gang.
That's great, dude.
The cruciferous crew.
Or the cruciferous bunch.
I like that.
All right.
Yeah, so that's awesome. Thank you for giving the trivia question, Kiki. When we put the post up on social media, react if you know the answer on Hot Redhead Media. And thanks to everyone for listening to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. To check out our newest curated watch lists and episode snacks anytime, please check out www.hotredheadmedia.com for our blog posts. And if you like books as well, check out Hot Redhead Media's bookish sister podcast, Book Tales, where HRM pairs custom cocktails with newly released books and author readings and craft talks. But if you like the focus on women creators in film and TV, subscribe to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood for more episodes on women reshaping the narrative in Hollywood. Episodes release once a month. Thanks again for listening. Till next time, stay awesome.